Hi, welcome.
Hello.
Hi, how are you? You're silenced. We'll start in 1 minute.
There was no. Okay.
Sorry, Larry, you had something you wanted
to say? I was just
saying
there was no reminder email this week. So if people didn't have it plugged in there, you know, sometimes where it says the shear is starting in 1 hour.
Yeah, it's like
2 hours,
five
or whatever.
Yeah,
five right, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so I'll move it up to Tracy. It usually goes out 10 minutes before the shear, right?
I think they're usually an hour or two.
Yeah.
Yeah. It usually says like the shear is starting in an hour, reminder, or the shear is starting in 2 hours.
Right. So how has learning with your kids been going?
You have a broader audience this week. Some of them have headphones on the other side of the
All right, that sounds good. So I last week we had a really great question that was asked, which is what happens when our children come home and they've heard something about what happens in the story in Chumash, and then they're looking in the Pesukim in the Chumash and they don't see that, and that can get really confusing. And you know, my teacher said this, and I look in the Pesukim, it's not here. And it is like a fun trivia to play. I like to play this with my students around Purim time, Pshat or Drash. You know, people are so familiar with the story of Megillas Esther, but you know, they don't. They might think they know the story, and you know, what they think they know are not necessarily in the Pesukim. So some things in the Pesukim are kind of, they go unstated and they're obvious. And some things are not. And you know, I just mentioned Esther. So one of the questions that I like to ask my students is Vashti executed? Is that Pshat or Drash? And it's funny because the Pesuk never says what happens to Vashti. But it's clearly Pshat that she's executed. So that's something that's unstated in the text, but it's obvious. It's obvious that that's the case. So you know, there can be things that are not said, but they're, you know, you work out, you figure out what's going on in the story. But another thing that we have to realize, and I think the best way to approach this question, and it's obviously helpful for Rashi pedagogically, is for us to teach our children and to reiterate to them that there is Torah Shebichtav and there is also Torah Shebaal Peh. And those are, they're both Torah. Both of those things are Torah. And when we're working on Chumash and Rashi, Rashi is bringing in Torah Shebaal Peh. They're not telling you what's in the Pesukim. They're not telling, sometimes Rashi is even to tell you how to interpret Pesukim, but it is different. And, you know, the question really is like, for example, the Avram story. So the Pesukim doesn't tell us about Avram and the Kivshon Ha'esh, the furnace of fire, or Avram smashing the idols of his father. The Torah tells us nothing of that. And in fact, it is a challenge that we should have on Torah Shebichtav. Why does Torah Shebichtav not tell us this? Right? Isn't it necessary for Torah Shebichtav to tell us the story? The Torah tells us the origin story for Moshe Rabbeinu and Yitzchak and Yaakov and Aaron HaKohen. They all have their origin stories. It's one of the great riddles that the Mefarshim deal with, is why is Avram's story not here? So you can look at that as kind of, this is a discussion of the Mefarshim, or you can realize, no, this is the content of Torah Shebaal Peh. For some reason, this discussion is not in Torah Shebichtav, right? This conversation is not in Torah Shebichtav. It's only in Torah Shebaal Peh. And our children will ask us, no, why is that the case? Why are some things not in Torah Shebichtav and they're only in Torah Shebaal Peh? And it's a hard thing to say to our children because it's hard for them to accept, but there are some things that they're not ready to hear about. There's some things that they're not ready to hear about. And Avram's story as a child is not something that children are ready to hear about. They're not ready to hear about, you know, what Avram's father did to him. They're not ready to hear about, you know, how Avram himself worshipped Abu Dazar as a child alongside his father. Those are things that are hard for any of us to even say. Avram says that Avram worshipped Abu Dazar with everyone else around. Difficult for us to say that. So there are some things that are, and we have to recognize that those things, these parts belong in Torah Shebaal Peh, but knowing that they exist can help us understand what's going on in Torah Shebichtav. So if our kids know that most of the Midrashim belong to the realm of Torah Shebaal Peh, and that they believe in Torah Shebaal Peh, and we believe in Torah Shebaal Peh, and alongside the tradition of this text, we have a tradition of Torah Shebaal Peh, and that's father to son, you know, going all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu, and there are more things that happen that get included in Torah Shebaal Peh. And that, I think, can be exciting for kids to learn that while Torah Shebichtav stands as it is, the text is here, and we need to know and understand the words of this text, Torah Shebaal Peh is ever expanding, right? Each time a person learns more about Torah Shebaal Peh, they're not only gaining knowledge, but they're adding another layer into the long history of Torah Shebaal Peh. You know, you can fit every, you know, all of Torah Shebichtav into one small book. You go into a base medrash and the shelves are full of Torah Shebaal Peh. And I think we need to teach our children that. And that's, I think, is really the heart of this, of answering this question. You know, I heard this, but it's not in the Psukim. Answer is, there are a lot of things that are not in the Psukim. You go to the Beis Medrash, show a child all the Sfarim that are there, you know, and the difference between the size of the Tanakh and the rest of Torah Shebaal Peh, and tell them that they're also writing Torah Shebaal Peh. That's the bracha. That's the bracha of Saint Chalkinu B'Zor HaSecha. Place our portion in this world in your Torah. We want to have a chelik in Torah. We want our chelik in our life to be part of Torah as well. And that's what's happening when learning is going on. It's just not information, but there's actually like a content of Torah Shebaal Peh that's being added onto. I think that's really, really important. And the other day, my son asked me if we can learn some halacha together. So, you know, his birthdays are on Hanukkah. It's on Hanukkah. So last year we did the Kitz of Shulchan Aruch and Hilchos Hanukkah. So he said, yeah, he wants to do another sefer on Hilchos Hanukkah. He knows, you know, we did the Kitz of Shulchan Aruch, so he wants to do the Shulchan Aruch. So I said, okay, I think we could do the Chai Adam. You know, that's good. So he says, like, no, I want to do the Shulchan Aruch, the Chai Adam. You know, the Chai Adam, like I did the Kitzur, I want to do the full thing now. So I said, I opened again the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, and I said, look, it's paragraph after paragraph, and it's, you know, it's one voice, Rabbi Danzig. Each paragraph is his voice. And if we look in the Chai Adam, it's one person writing each paragraph. And my son has just started learning Gemara, so he knows this. Gemara in the center, and then there's Rashi on the side, which he hasn't learned yet. Post on the other side, he hasn't learned yet. But he knows what the Gemara looks like. I just opened up a Shulchan Aruch for him. I showed him this little bit of Shulchan Aruch. And then there's the Magen Avraham, and there's the Taz, and then there's the Be'er Hitiv, and, you know, commentary after commentary after commentary. I said, they're all having a discussion. So we would drown if we tried to jump into Torah Shebaal Peh like that. We have to work towards Torah Shebaal Peh really, really, really slowly. And it starts with seeing the Torah Shebaal Peh that's layered on top of Torah Shebichtav in Rashi. So Rashi is still working Torah Shebichtav, but he's bringing in the other elements of Torah Shebaal Peh. So Rashi limits himself. And this was like a big novelty that Rashi did. Other commentaries, you know, prior to Rashi, felt an insistence to kind of, you want to add Torah Shebaal Peh to Torah Shebichtav. Okay, so here's all of what Torah Shebaal Peh has to say. Here's all the midrashim about this topic. And Rashi's genius was to pick one medrash on each question that he has, and to show, and which medrash does he pick? He picks, Rashi says explicitly, I'm going to pick only the midrashim that fit best with explaining the psukim. They fit with the diktuk of the psukim. So learning Rashi carefully will introduce our children to the beginnings of Torah Shebaal Peh, you know, and kind of the crossover between Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. But they have to know that that's happening. That crossover is happening. It's not just, a commentary on Torah Shebichtav. And if they think it's just that, then they will get confused. And they'll say, well, why is Rashi saying something that's not in the words? They realize Rashi's helping bridge the gap between Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. So two most important things that are coming out from this is that there is another Torah called Torah Shebaal Peh. Moshe Rabbeinu got both of them at Har Sinai. And Torah Shebichtav is stagnant. It is what it is. And Torah Shebaal Peh, every time they learn it, they're adding another layer onto it. And the next thing is that Rashi's kind of leading us into Torah Shebaal Peh and helping us understand the psukim in the context of Torah Shebaal Peh. So those are, I think, the main points. And once that's established, that there are certain parts of the psukim, certain parts of the stories that the psukim are describing that are not in Torah Shebichtav, but there are allusions to where they are in Torah Shebaal Peh, then I think a lot of these questions will go away. A lot of these questions will just naturally go away. And then, you know, when you look at Rashi, you could try to figure out why Rashi's picking this medrash over some of the more exciting midrashim, or why Rashi doesn't quote some of the more exciting midrashim. Rashi's really just, you know, helping us step into getting our feet wet in Torah Shebaal Peh. That's the first step. We should also realize that Rashi's midrashim that he quotes, they're always sharper in the diktuk than pshat. It's interesting. People like to think, well, midrashim are, you know, the pshat is literally what happened and the midrashim is figurative. So it might be the case that a medrash is talking figuratively, but the reason why Rashi is quoting the medrash is because it reads the pasuk in a literal way. So for example, by the Makkah of Shechem, the pasuk says that Moshe raised his hands al Hashemah. So, you know, early Chumash learners will know al means on. So what does it mean Moshe raised his hands on the heavens? So Rashi says, al derech pshat, I mean, did I say this one a couple weeks ago? Right, al derech pshat, Al Hashemayim means towards the heavens. And this is one of those few places in Tanakh where the word Al doesn't mean on, but the word Al context helps us appreciate that the word Al here must mean towards. But Rashi quotes the Medrash that Hashem raised Moshe up over Shemayim, and then Moshe literally raised his hands Al Hashemayim, above, on top of the heavens. Okay, great. So we could try to figure out what the figurative point of this medrash is trying to say, but we can understand Rashi's quoted this medrash not because it's super cool, not because Moshe's flying around in Shemayim, not because, you know, this, you could think about Neo flying around the Matrix and you know, did Moshe inspire Neo? That's not the reason. It is really cool, but Rashi's choosing this medrash because it answers the question of Al Hashemayim, on the heavens. So it's a literal read of the text. And the next thing is to say, well, you know, why, you know, what is this point? What is this comment that Torah Shavuot is trying to tell us? And I think that is a significant context, right? What's the whole greater context of the Makos is to show that God is above all of these forces of nature that power had been worshiping. So Moshe, as God's emissary, talking this out and proving this to Paro, Moshe it's as if he's being raised above these heavenly forces that Paro is worshiping. So, you know, Al Hashemayim, yeah, Moshe in that sense, figuratively, was above all these heavenly forces that Paro worshiped. So that's what the Medrash is telling us in a metaphoric way, but picking up an aspect of the literal text in the pasuk. So it's kind of like a bridge of literal to metaphoric to what actually happened. So you have to, in that sense, darshan medrash to figure out what it's saying on both ends. Figure out why it's connected to the pasuk of Al Hashemayim, and figure out what the intent of the medrash is trying to tell us about this story. And that second part of what the medrash is trying to tell us, that I think is more loosely defined than the first part. So the first part, how it goes to the text, there is like a very specific correct answer to this question. How does this medrash answer Rashi's question? There is one or two questions that it could be answering, and you need to work at the diktuk and be precise and exact. And as students, as our children work on that, their own diktuk skills will get sharper. They'll start to read psukim the way Rashi reads psukim. They'll start to be much more nuanced and subtle and think about kind of certain patterns in the text. And that will make them really like Rashi learners. They won't even need Rashi. They'll be looking at psukim and you know, being mechabing to all the questions that Rashi will have. Well, that's at the first end, how the medrash, you know, connects to the pasuk. And then you get into the metaphoric sense and you ask, what's the medrash trying to say? And that's, now you're in the realm of Torah Shavuot Peh. Right, you've made the jump. You're in Torah Shavuot Peh. What's the medrash trying to say? And now it is looser. It really is looser. And so you ask your child, what do you think this medrash is saying about Moshe and Shemayim and his hands? And what does Shemayim mean to Paro? And I think we find that when we present that as a riddle, you know, what might this medrash be saying? We'll find that our kids are creative and they have a lot to say. And they could come up with really, really great answers. And this is their chilek in Torah Shebaal Peh. That's their chilek. And they should know, they should get excited that they've added another line to Torah Shebaal Peh. You can't add lines to Torah Shebaal Peh. You have to be rigid and structured and concrete when you figure out how Rashi, you know, got into the Medrash. But on the other hand, on the other side, what's the metaphor that the Medrash is saying? That's their time to be creative, to shine. It's kind of open, you can discuss it. Do you think, ask them if it could be saying that, you know, is it saying something else? You know, there's definitely more room for a child to express himself. So there should be two parts, kind of rigidity and exactness about connecting with the tzukim, and that's the Torah Shabbat side. And the Torah Shabbat side is, in a certain sense, it has to be looser. It's more alive. It's more part of the relationship between you and the text and you and your teacher, a child and a parent. So that's, I think, the right way to approach this question about Torah Shebaal Peh and Torah Shebichtav. And I think the right way to to kind of take a step back. The child comes home and says, I heard this and I don't understand it. I heard this, it doesn't fit in the psukim. We're reading the psukim, and we realize we need to take a big step back. I have a couple of parsha readers at home that I read to my little kids and my older kids when they were little. This is before we started learning Chumash, before they could even read. And my kids really like them. And we bought a few. I'm actually going to pull them off the shelf right now just to show you. So these are the parsha readers that I have, and you know, some of it's you know, if he wants to see the whole parsha, this is the one that I really like, my first parsha reader, and you know, the kids just want to know what's in the psukim. So in these, it's really good, simple pictures, and it has what I really enjoy is that the story that's in the parsha reader is the story of Torah Shebichta. It almost never deviates from the story that is in the psukim. I think it's like one exception in Parashas Noach, by Migdal Bavel, where the Torah Shebichta is really, really unclear what the sin is. So they have to take a stance on what the sin is, otherwise the story doesn't make any sense. So that's this parsha reader, and I love to read this parsha reader with my kids. They ask me, but sure, we go to the couch, pick it up, and read. These we bought ourselves. This is another parsha reader that I was granted as a gift, and it has fantastic pictures, and I really, really dislike reading it to my kids, but my kids really like the pictures. The reason why I dislike reading it is because it's completely Torah Shebaal Peh. The whole parsha reader is just midrashim woven into pieces of the story. They're midrashim that are inconsistent with each other, that are kind of someone trying to figure out how to put them all together into a picture book. And I feel like children who are pre-Chumash learners, right? They're just learning about the parsha. We should be kind of hesitant to teach them midrashim, and I really feel it will confuse them. And this is something that I really like. I don't know what to do. I know there are teachers who are teaching midrashim in their parsha classes, and I just have to, like, you know, I just listen and I hear what my kids have to say, and I'm basically silent. And if my kids ask me to read these books, then I wanna you know, give them an opportunity to read through the book. We read it, but if it was my choice, I would always choose the one that you know, leans towards Torah Shebichta, because that's the point. Torah Shebaal Peh, they're not really ready for most of the content of Torah Shebaal Peh. It is, it requires a more subtle, sensitive, and mature mind that our early Chumash learners are getting to.
Not for your youngest kids with the Parsha readers, but once they're already learning Chumash and a teacher, let's say even not in what they're learning in Chumash, but just, you know, kind of the part of the week where they go over the Parsha, right?
Yeah.
From their Chumash teacher. So, and when they're bringing a Midrash, do you when they say it over at the Shabbos table, do you highlight to them, oh, that's a Midrash? Or do you, you know, like, do you ever, not to criticize the teacher, but just highlighting, you know, what the pshat is versus, you know, what, you hear what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
do you
I
ever,
hear what you're saying. I think it's better not to label something as medrash, because what would I be trying to do if I said that? I would instead to say, you know, this is, oh, that appears in the Gemara, or that appears in Medrash Rabbah. I think that's important to do. That's a part of Torah Shebaal Peh. I think to label something as Medrash, because, you know, there's kind of like, I want to explain why. We don't want that word to be seen in any way, shape, or form as a pejorative or a way of saying that something is not true. And that's kind of like a real big danger that we don't want to open up. There is, like, right, Rashi distinguishes frequently between pshat and drash. He says, "Pshuto," and then he says, Rabbi Hussein of Darshi the following. Rashi thinks both of those are important to study. There's no question about that. But somehow it has entered into the lexicon that you know, someone might suggest an explanation and you might respond to that with, that's not pshat. And what they really mean is, that's not right. And that can get confusing. That can get very confusing. So if you're labeling something as medrash, you want to make sure what you're saying doesn't come off as that's not pshat, meaning that's not true, and then equate that's midrashic with that's not pshat. Nechama Leibovitz had a really funny line about this kind of question about what is pshat and what is drash, and I assume it was said tongue in cheek. And she said, pshat, how do you know what's pshat and what's drash? Pshat is what I say, and drash is what you say. So it's a great line. It really drives home this point that, you know, there is an obfuscation of these words, and we don't want to make that mistake. Rashi's definitely not saying, Rabbi Hussein Darshi, to mean, oh, you want to hear something crazy? That's not what Rashi means to say at all, right? He wants to say that there is a deep thing here. There's a deep layer that can be pulled out. You know, my wife has a lesson that she introduces the bridge between Torah Shavapan and Torah Shavaktav by writing a poem on the board. And she has it's quite an extensive lesson about how Torah is poetry. And poetry by its nature has layers of meaning. There's the meaning of the words, and then there's the meaning that comes from the choice of the meter that the poet uses, or the choice for his rhyme scheme, etc. So, and she has a couple of poems that she uses as her example. So she wants to say, Aliza wants to say that Torah is like that too. It has multiple layers, and that's a good way to think about drash. But again, that doesn't explain all of Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah Shebaal Peh is its own thing. Some of Torah Shebaal Peh, we should realize, some Torah Shebaal Peh never ever comes close to Torah Shebaktav at all. Right? For example, the shi'urim, the size of things, is completely in Torah Shebaal Peh. The Torah never tells you how big a mikveh is. The Torah never tells you how big a ham is, how big a tefach is. These are necessary features of halacha that are exclusively in Torah Shebaal Peh, and there's no hint to these things in Torah Shebaktav. How many walls a sukkah has, right? Maybe there's a hint to that, maybe not. So we do have to realize that fact. That's first. And the second thing is as our students get older and they recognize, they start to realize that some midrashim are really important to understanding the story. And some midrashim are not so important to understanding the story, and they seem to be extra. So the Rambam says very interestingly, he says there are some important Torah Shebaal Peh principles that don't come from any overt lesson in a pasuk, but Chazal they hung this principle on a phrase in the Torah because it sounds good, in order that we should remember that principle. So that's an important thing for us to realize, that sometimes the medrash that we're looking at, and Rashi will not quote medrash like this so frequently, but it will come up as they continue learning. But the Rambam insists that there are some medrashim that are really only there connected to the pasuk as a mnemonic device. So for example, the pasuk says, Lo yiyah b'kirbecha elzar, right? So it literally means, you shall not have within you foreign god. So b'kirbecha, within you, that's another way of saying amongst you, amongst the nations, should not be a foreign god. Okay. But the Gemara in Shabbat says, Lo yiyah b'kirbecha elzar, you should look at a person who has anger issues as if he worships Avodah Zarah. Because Eza El Zar Shebekir Becha, what's the foreign power that's within a person that will make him do something that, you know, retrospectively he'll ask himself, what was I thinking? Why did I do that? I lost control. So in that sense, anger is an Elzar. So the Rambam would say that's a mnemonic device. That's a mnemonic device to help us appreciate that there isn't really a pasuk in the Torah that tells us anger is a bad midah. There isn't a pasuk in the Torah that says that. But this pasuk could show us how detrimental anger is. You'll look back and think, I wasn't in control at all. Some other entity was in control. No, you lost control. That's the definition of anger. And in that sense, it's kind of like Avodah Zarah. There's an El Zarah within you. So I mean, I guess you can quibble and try to figure out maybe that is a layer of understanding of that pasuk. But I think the simple pshat is that the Rambam would say, the simple meaning is that the Rambam would say that this is, and this is being used as a mnemonic device, because we should recognize what anger is. There isn't a story in Tanakh that reflects this point, but here, right here, this pasuk can help us appreciate that. So one of the parts of Torah Shabbat Peh and connecting the pasukim is not to explain the pshat of the pasuk, but it's to help us give airtime in Tanakh for these principles that are really Torah Shabbat Peh principles. And that also can be helpful for our kids, for them to realize that this medrash is not trying to say this is alluded to in the pasuk. It's not. This medrash is a standalone principle, and we're connecting it to a pasuk, so that way we remember it. That way this principle becomes ingrained in our tutelage, and we're brought up with this principle. And if it was just in Torah Shabbat Peh, we might not ever find, you know, if it just appeared in that Gemara and Shabbos, so then only the people who come across that Gemara and Shabbos would come across that. And if you did Daf Yomi, you would come across this point about anger every 7.5 years, right? But since it appears in a pasuk, and we say that pasuk in the Shir Shalom, you know, every Thursday, so we're reminded about that principle every Thursday, you know, don't get angry. The Shir Shalom. Okay. I think we did quite a bit about Torah Shabbat Peh. I definitely want to make sure that I pause for questions. On Rashi, on Medrash, on Torah Shabbat Peh, but also on anything. Anybody have any questions on anything we've been discussing, or on Loni Chumash, or other questions that have come up? Hey, Larry, I think you mentioned a couple, you mentioned that, like, when a student comes home with a student, a child has a Dvar Torah or a Medrash. Are they reading from something, or it's something they learned in school and, like, they're saying it over and you're talking about
it? It could be both.
Depending
on the year, right, and right. The teacher. Sometimes they're saying it over what they learned, you know, in class. Sometimes they maybe have notes on it, and sometimes they're reading it direct. It really just depends on the year and the teacher and the...
Right.
Yeah.
So far, they haven't been using their sheets. They have sheets.
This year,
yeah. At least the boys, like, but they're just speaking without the sheet.
That's so great.
Yeah.
Did you encourage that, or they decided on their own to do that?
They all like to share, so that they've gotten to the habit of, like, standing up, like they're giving a speech, each one.
Oh, that's so nice.
So they enjoy doing that.
Yeah.
So they don't need too much encouragement on that.
That's really great. That's really, really great. Yeah, I know, like, lots of families have different approaches to appreciating it. But I think it's important to make a Dvar Torah significant, as, like, it's an important feature of the Shabbos table. But somehow to do that with putting on minimal pressure, and it's not really possible to figure out how to do both of those things. I think I mentioned the other week that Rabbi Mutinki would just ask his children, is there something you want to tell me about the parasha? And, you know, refuse to do the questions on the parasha. I know other people who wanted their kids to be able to speak, and they refused to allow them to read from the sheet. They had to prepare the Dvar Torah beforehand and be able to say it over, which obviously is, like, that's very formal, you know, very proper. I remember being at a Shabbos table with Ephraim Rimmel, and Ephraim You should get her for Shalema. Brian, it's funny. Itai, his oldest son, I don't know, maybe he was 6 or 7, basically didn't like any of the Shabbos food that was on the table. But as a reward for answering the questions right, his father would give him the very Shabbos food that he didn't want to eat, and then he would like happily eat it, which is, I thought it was just totally absurd and hilarious. But that was their custom. That was what, you know, that's what they brought up doing in my house. As I went out as a kid, one of six, and we were very competitive. We were ferocious. My father, each of us had to either sing a song or sing a Dvar Torah or tell a story. And I remember one Shabbos telling a story that I had obviously told the week before, and I was shot down. Like, no, you can't just say the same story every week. And I remember going after my siblings if they said a Dvar Torah that I had a question on. And my father really enjoyed it. He would moderate our debates about the Dvar Torah. And for me, some of my, my most precious memories of as a child were these big debates that we had in the Pesukim and Chazal and philosophy, free will. I had a big discussion about free will one time, Pesach, Seder night. And my mother would always be like, no, let's go on in the Seder. My father says, no, this is what we need to hear. I think it's important to make a big deal. But sometimes it's hard for a kid to be at the Shabbos table. You know, especially if a parent is saying a Dvar Torah, I'm thinking about myself, I'm saying a Dvar Torah. My kids can't sit through, a Dvar Torah that I want to share. So when we choose our Dvar Torah for ourselves, we have to choose something that is interactive, that the kids can participate in if there are simple parts to it. Or if they could, they could conclude it, or however it is, they can interpret it. We have to make our debate tool really, 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 really simple and interactive and exciting, prominent in our Shabbos meal, yet not too serious that they can't access it. One of the games that my kids really like to play, which is really good for Bereishis. As the parashas get on, the game has to be changed a little bit, is they really like to play 21 questions. And basically, you choose a character in the Chumash, in the parasha, and the kids have to try to figure out who it is based on their questions. And it's, 21 questions is, they never need more than 5 or 6 questions to do it. But it helps them appreciate what's in the parasha, and little kids can even little kids who are pre Chumash learners can do such.
Maybe just connecting what you were saying about at the Shabbos table, Divrei Torah, and then going back to the Parsha readers too. So someone had given us as a gift the book Vaha'erev Na, so we started to do that week by week, and the kids would read part of the setup, the story, And then, what I liked about it, I didn't even like some of the, I shouldn't say it that way. But whatever it was, but what I liked best about it, maybe that's the best way to say it, is the halachic, thought process that they had, I saw every week as we started to do it more and more, they started to pick up on the key parts of the stories, right? And then you saw what the halachic thought process was kind of that they were developing based on what the challenge or whatever he calls it and the solution right out of each parsha kind of was. So I'm wondering, I'm just using that one as an example because we got it as a gift and we were using it. But do you think any of those kind of what I'll call more advanced parsha readers, let's say for as they get older, are there any there that, and obviously if you're not prepared to think about what they are.
No, I'll definitely look into what are good examples of that. But I think a lot of kids are really into Vaha'erev Na and adults also. I think it's a good, in that sense, you said it's advanced. I think it is advanced, but only you have to be able to read. A student who can read can really get into it and they can really think about what are the competing values And even if a kid doesn't know the strict halachic categories for each of these values, they can pick up on those values and try to guess which one is going to be the more significant one. Something that I don't like about the Harivna is that I never seem to get the answer right. It kills me. I feel like I should know the answer, and then I can't get it right. And then when the answer comes, I'm like, I still feel like I was right. So I'll look into that. I've seen other books there, but Harivna is very good. The stories are often very compelling, and the kids really, really like the stories. So as much as we have to grit our teeth about not always getting the right answer, but if the kids like the Harivna, then you should definitely stick with it. I know there's like a volume 2 also and a volume 3 now. So if you feel like you've exhausted all of those, I'll definitely look into it. I've seen, I'm trying to think off the top of my head, what are the other examples of that? I'll have to get back to you. I've seen other things that are similar to it. Yeah. There's a pamphlet that has been coming. It's been coming around from Victor Miller that has similar kind of presentation, where there's like a story that's only only tangentially related to the parasha that you could potentially figure out. But I'll try. It's a good question. I'll try to get back to you. I'll try that. Any other questions for further research that I could look into? I'm
looking for your recommendations for partial readers to absolutely avoid at all costs.
Oh, yeah, you want that? I heard someone say once that the Little Midrash says is like borderline heresy. And this was years ago, and I was like very offended to hear that. But I've come around. Now I appreciate what that person was saying. So yeah, not heresy, but you have to recognize what Torah Shabbat is. And my wife is making faces at me. That was not appropriate to say. But yeah, okay. Yeah, Harivna. I think it is a really great. It's a great the whole presentation and the writing style. I wonder who translated it. I mean, Zilberstein didn't write in English. Yeah, I have to look into it. Okay, all right. Thank you, everybody, for joining me. This is really, really great. Next week, we'll make sure to send out the email in advance the warning, and we'll talk about more of the Shabbos table. And more of these questions of kind of getting a parasha, not just a one-on-one learning, but also more of like a family time parasha. Okay. All right.
Thank you, Rabbi. Have a good week.
Thank you. Have a good night. Thanks.